Okay, hi comrades. This is another step in a discussion which has been running for the last few months. I guess that most of the interlocutors in this discussion actually aren't here for this meeting, but nonetheless, it may be of some use. And background to it, the Young Communist League, attached to the Communist Party of Britain, which is in turn the appendage of the Morning Star, had a at least temporary, I don't know how long, whether it's lasted, upturn of militancy and spectaculars in appearance of using masks, red flags, and so on and so forth. Presenting in a sense well to the left of the official CPB. Socialist Appeal has decided in summer, ran a campaign, Are You a Communist? Then Get Organized, joined Socialist Appeal, and has now decided to rebrand itself as the Revolutionary Communist Party, reappropriating a name first used by a trot group of the 1940s, but then subsequently used by the Frank Furedi and Co. For a well, I'm not going to characterize the group. Talking about socialism from a Marxist point of view of Nick Rackham, Will McMahon, and others, issued a left unity appeal without offering any explanation of how their left unity appeal was different from anybody else's left unity appeal, including from CPGB's long-term campaigning for some sort of left unity. We did then have an exchange, and at that point it became clear that talking about socialism, we're not in fact willing to talk with to CPGB because they regard us as being marginal and unimportant because they're busy building up their own organization. Because we were rude to them in some way. I'm not quite clear how we were rude to them, but we were rude to them in some way. Comrade Lawrence Parker, who has a widely read blog on communist history, has embarked in the last few months on a system of negative criticism of CPGB PCC on the basis that our organization is quote going nowhere, and the reason for our going nowhere is pass quote passivity or sluggishness of method, whatever the hell, unclear what the hell is meant by that. Again, we've had exchanges between the let in the letters pages and the pages of the paper about this stuff. Background. In terms of the background, what we see is of the state of the left is actually the left moving in relation to the objective needs of politics in ever decreasing circles. Starmer, assuming that he wins the election, which now looks likely, general election, will be the most right-wing Labour Prime Minister presiding over the most right-wing Labour government. That's not all saying a great deal, because if we think about how right-wing Ramsay MacDonald's government in 1924 was, or the role of Henderson and Co. in supporting the British war effort in 1914-18, it is nonetheless the objective dynamic is dilution, 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 and has been really the Wilson government was well to the right of the Attlee government, and the Blair government was a long way to the right of. The second Wilson government was to the right of the first Wilson government. The Blair government was a long way to the right of the Wilson government. But Starmer will be to the right of Blair, And as we saw again with the Tories, the same dynamic. The Macmillan government was slightly to, the Eden and Macmillan governments were well obviously to the right of the Labour Party, but the Heath government was sufficiently far to the right. Heath was sufficiently far to the right of Macmillan to gain the appellation, quote, Selsdon man for the supposedly far right character of the Heath government. The Thatcher government was notoriously way to the right of the Heath government. And the Cameron government signalled its intentions from the outset by taking the Tory party out of the centre-right group in the European Parliament to form a new far-right group together with the Italian post-fascists and other characters of this sort. Yeah. So the Starmer government will be for a very right-wing government, and it will be succeeded by an even more a conservative government, which is to the right of Braverman and Sunak and these characters. We see have seen a succession of small left electoral initiatives of one sort and another, broadly trying to pretend to be left Labour. Yeah. Going back to the Socialist Labour Party in the early 1990s, the Socialist Alliances, Respect, and so on and so on. And we see more currently Trade Union Socialist Coalition, etc., etc., etc. And this stuff, we're doing the same thing over and over again. And we're doing the same thing over and over again with decreasing returns. On the other hand, we have seen in the last few months, in the last year or so, perhaps, or few months, a significant uptick in student radicalisation. The YCL is an example of this, but it's also been there's also been a significant recovery of the Socialist Workers' Party, which the people who remember the Martin Smith scandal have all moved on, and the SWP is back to being able to recruit significant numbers at the Freshers' Fair and turn them out. Socialist appeal has grown rapidly among students. When one sees them on the demonstrations, it's quite clear that it's basically a student organisation with an older generation. RS21 has trebled or quadrupled in size again, basically because it's based, this is an organisation based among students. Student radicalism has this character that the past is very easily forgotten. There's a 3 or 4 year turnover and of activists, and therefore it's perfectly possible if you're doing student politics and you're in student politics to follow the line, the membership has failed us, we must elect a new membership. And people have indeed succeeded to a considerable extent in electing a new membership. But it's this which gives the appearance of success to Socialist Appeal, to RS21, and so on. It's also the case, however, the flip side of it, if I cast my mind back to the 1970s, the Maoist CPGBML and the Healyites and so on were perfectly capable of organising meetings in Oxford University without themselves having students in the university and recruit into the universities from the outside. That's become a lot more difficult. Universities have tightened up massively on who gets to turn up to freshers' fairs. And more generally, actually, there's elaborate security controls on who can book meetings and so on and so forth. So you can recruit among students if you've already got students to organise from the inside. That is a adverse has adverse effects on us. It also, I think, has adverse effects on several other left groups which don't have already existing student presence. Anti-capitalist resistance, I think, is another example of that. It's difficult to get break into that from the outside. Nonetheless, I posed the question in my most recent article on this topic that it's possible that it's impossible for the CPGB's project to work, which is what Talking About Socialism argues, is that the CPGB's polemical character of the paper is repellent. It's impossible for the CPGB's project, therefore, to work, and therefore, what? As far as Talking About Socialism is concerned, their counterproposal is, in essence, an organization based on a platform which is formed by private diplomatic agreements and was not open to discussion as to what the platform should be. The platform has drawn, as was the case with the socialist platform in Left Unity, is so drawn as to be capable of including the Alliance for Workers' Liberty without discomfort, in spite of the fact that the Alliance for Workers' Liberty is an anti-imperialist organization whose line on questions of imperialism and war is broadly one of the that we should oppose all forms of imperialism other than British and American imperialism. Diplomatic formulations are adopted which allow the Alliance for Workers' Liberty in, but at the same time, the diplomatic formulations are not in principle amendable. And the principle of politeness is adopted, that it's necessary to avoid sharp arguments and sharp polemics in order to avoid repellent, quote, repellent, unquote, polemical publication. We are also running a debate in the letters column of the paper with Andrew Northall, who argues that the line of the Communist Party of Britain, and indeed of the traditional official Communist Party, of banning factions, which in fact is also, as it happens, the line of the Socialist Workers' Party, banning permanent factions, and before that of the American Socialist Workers' Party and all of the satellite organizations of the American Socialist Workers' Party banning, quote, permanent factions, is essential to serious organization. Now, I argued in my most recent article that actually, if we are wrong on the question of factions and on the question of open polemic, then it follows in reality that the labor bureaucracy and the capitalist state have succeeded so success have been so successful in breeding short-beaked pigeons. Trotsky in 1926 in Where Is Britain Going? Talked about the pigeon fancier who breeds short pigeons, which are so short-beaked that they can't get out of the shell on their own. Breeding short-beaked pigeons that the victory of the right wing in the labor movement is guaranteed, and if the victory of the right wing in the labor movement is guaranteed, then the victory of the right overall is guaranteed. And the underlying dynamic of capitalist politics towards World War III is guaranteed to proceed more or less unabated. I give you two things which I regard as being fundamental lessons on this question. The first is actually the fall of the Union of Soviet USSR. The fall of the USSR demonstrated, in the first place, that the regime in which the bureaucracy had a monopoly of what could be said produced a regime in which the managers lied to the planning authorities, the planning authorities lied to the party about the progress of the plan, and the workers lied to the managers about their work. And the end result of this is the famous Soviet joke, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. The result is a radical demoralization and very widespread illusions in the direct political agents of capitalism, reflected in the fact that significant parts of the working class in the East European countries and in Russia itself actually supported the overthrow of the USSR and the satellite regimes. Secondly, the institutional forms of the regime, and here the ban on factions is absolutely central, it entailed that once the core leadership of the party decided to restore capitalism, which is essentially what happened under Gorbachev and Yeltsin, there was no institutional means within the regime by which anybody could resist. And indeed, once we see that there's no institutional means within the regime by which anybody can resist, we can see that whatever the hell we characterize, however the hell we characterize this regime, it is not the dictatorship of the proletariat. Because the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie means that the capitalist class at the end of the day is above the law and has a veto on what happens. And we can see that, at, for example, in the fuel duty escalator protests in the early 2000s, that the capitalist class is able to essentially veto the proposed legislation. And we can see any number of other examples of this, of one sort and another. The proletariat did not have any institutional forms by which he could do that. The reason is precisely because why we think the proletariat as a class is the potential bearer of socialism is because the proletariat as a class needs to organize collective action in order to assert its interests. And that is just as much true in a regime which purports to be a workers' regime as it is in a capitalist regime, a point which Lenin made against Trotsky in the trade union, in the debate on the militarization of labor and the trade unions in 1920. The proletariat still needs to organize, but then the corollary of that is if you ban all the parties other than the Communist Party, and you ban all factions within the Communist Party, the upshot of that is going to be there is no means by which the proletariat can collectively organize to assert its interests if it happens to be the case that the political leadership becomes is captured by pro-capitalist elements. The comrades of the CPB Morning Star and the people who hold similar views about the ban on factions or the ban on permanent factions or whatever we like to call it need to accept political responsibility for the collapse of the Soviet Union, both because the regime of lies, which was enabled by the absence of competing factional views, produced utter demoralization of everybody in the regime and in the working class in the societies. And because it also meant that once the leaders of the regime set themselves to restore capitalism, nobody could effectively resist. Second lesson, Corbynism. What happened in Corbynism is that the far left clings to unity with the official left and avoids openly denouncing the official left. The official left clings to unity with the right wing of the labour movement because there's no way in which you can get a labour government without the unity between the labour left and the labour right. The labor right, in coordination with the capitalist state and media, witch hunts the labor left and the far the official left and the far left, so that the inability, the clinging to unity on the basis of diplomacy, unity without open controversy, unity without denunciation and polemic, entails that result. It's a natural and probable consequence of that result, that as long as the far left continues diplomatic towards the official left, and the official left continues diplomatic towards the right will be victorious. The victory of the right is guaranteed, and we saw it in Corbynism. We've seen it actually in different forms in Rifondazione Comunista in Italy, in the decision of the leadership of Rifondazione Comunista to join a government which was backing the imperialist war in Afghanistan, and the result of that was the total and utter destruction of Rifondazione Comunista, with what was left behind merely gravel. And we've seen it in the fate of the left in the Brazilian Partido dos Trabalhadores, the Brazilian Workers' Party, which originated as a broad left, broad front unification on the basis of, again, diplomatic methods in relation to political differences. So the approach of the Morningstar CPB, of the ban on factions within the party in order to preserve unity in action, and outside the party, that necessitates diplomatic approaches, because if you can't have unity without suppressing op the open discussion of differences within the party, then it follows inescapably that to have unity outside the party, we also need toning down diplomatic approaches to the question of party. So the Morningstar CPB's policy has been actually tested and fails on the largest possible scale in the USSR, and on the very large scale, that of Corbynism, in the Labour Party with Corbynism, in Rifondazione, in the Partido dos Trabalhadores. There are umpteen other examples. I've just given those ones because they're very large examples. But the Morningstar CPB policy is not only that of the Morningstar CPB, it's shared by the Socialist Workers' Party in its policy within Stop the War Coalition, Respect, and so on and so forth. It's shared by the Socialist Party of England and Wales in its policy in the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, and so on. It's shared by anti-capitalist resistance, which is, of course, the political co-thinker of the architects of diplomatic unity in Rifondazione, and of the Trotskyist bit of the architects of diplomatic unity in Rifondazione and in the Partido dos Trabalhadores. I have to say, actually, that this goes back to the policy of diplomatic unity pursued by Ernest Mandel and others in the Belgian Socialist Party in the early 1960s, by Ken Coates and co. in relation to the Labour left. In the late 1960s, pushed back further. This is the policy of Pierre Franck and Raymond Molinier in the La Commune newspaper in the 1930s, and both in relation to the French Socialist Party and later the Parti Socialiste Ouvrier Paysan, PSOP. So this is an old, long-running issue. It goes back to Georgi Dimitrov's reinterpretation of the policy of the United Front at the Seventh Congress of the Communist International in 1936. So I approach the point that this doesn't work, and it is also the case that talking about socialism also offers the method of diplomatic unity and the method of politeness. So imagine That the tens of thousands, or I mean, there are tens of thousands of ex-members of left groups of one sort and another who haven't gone over to the right, all flock round talking about socialism on the basis of adopting the general principled approach of talking about socialism. The result will be a repetition of the catastrophe of the Corbyn movement, because they. On the policy has been tried and fails on the largest possible scale. Now I turn from the negative to the positive. What is it that we're after? The first point, communist unity, not socialist unity. Communist unity, because although it would be nice to have a unified workers' in party and a unified workers' international, which included the right wing of the movement on the basis that the right wing of the movement was willing to act in a disciplined fashion, the reality is that the right wing of the movement is not willing to act in a disciplined fashion. The right wing of the movement collaborates with the capitalist state. To exercise police control over the movement. And as Lenin and Zinoviev wrote in 1915, on all important occasions, for example, the voting on August the 4th, 1914, the opportunists come forward with an ultimatum, which they carry out with the aid of their numerous connections with the bourgeoisie, of their majority of the executives of the trade unions, etc. And this is utterly transparent that this is the normal practice of the right wing of the labour movement as it is. So, communist unity, the unity of those who stand for the overthrow of the capitalist state, the overthrow of the regime of imperialism, who stand for generalized human emancipation, including the emancipation of all the people who the whose lives don't matter in the eyes of the imperialists, like the people in Gaza, or the people targeted in Yemen for years by Saudi Arabia serving the United States as agencies, and so on, and so on, and so on. Communist unity, not unity with the anti-imperialists, not unity with the labor right, not unity. In the first place, not unity with people who are loyalists towards the state. We need the unity of the ability of the communist left, the left which does stand on the fundamental difference of being anti-war and anti-imperialism and anti the state order. Before we can address the question of unity, partial unity with the loyalist element of the labor movement, we need that partly because our own ability to combat the loyalist wing of the labor movement is massively undermined by the disunity of the communists, as the inability of the communists to unite as communists. Second point, we need to organize. On this point, the CPGB comrades are together on the same side as Socialist Workers' Party, Socialist Appeal, Socialist Party of England and Wales, Communist Party of Britain, and so on, and against the various We Stand for Independence. We need a political voice. This is not a matter of it's the Leninist Combat Party, or whatever the hell you want to call it. We need a political voice, and we need a political voice entails the ability to run election campaigns if we have the resources to run election campaigns, entails the ability to publish regular newspapers and other journals and publications which can combat the exclusive, the monopoly of the capitalist controlled media. In order to have that, we need to have organized membership. We need to have dues raised from membership. We need to draw a line on the basis so that people get to vote on the basis that they participate and pay dues. We need to have fund drives. We need to have assets and organizational structures and all of these things, simply because if we don't, actually, we can't. If we don't take the steps which are necessary to do these things, we can't. All we get is one or another form of ephemera, left unity, the various different fronts and coalitions and organized short-lived organizations. That is that's fundamental. We are for organizing. Third element, it's necessary to be willing to be a minority and to be willing, as a majority, if you happen to be a majority, to be willing to risk being a minority. It's necessary to take seriously the discussions which we have among ourselves. And not say the discussions which we have among ourselves are a waste of time. We need to turn outwards to the masses or outwards to the broader forces, etc., etc., etc. Educate, agitate, organize. Educate, and educate in this case, and organize both involve taking seriously the political debates among ourselves. They involve, being willing to, as I said, being willing to go on as a minority fighting within an organization which you think is going badly wrong. It means being willing as a majority to put up with the disruptive complaints and arguments and grumbles and so on and so forth of the minority. It means, therefore, necessarily the acceptance that there will be factions, that there will be dissent, that there will be disagreements of one sort and another. If we can do that, then in principle, we could unify the forces of the Morning Stars Communist Party and Socialist Party of England and Wales and Socialist Workers Party and all the rest of us smaller groups, the rest of us, because the rest of us are all a lot smaller than these groups. I suppose Socialist Appeal is doing better at the moment, but interesting question. And by unifying, actually, if we unify, it's possible that we could bring in motion a snowball effect. Workers' Party, I gave you the examples of the Workers' Party and Rifondazione. Both of those are failed examples, but they're also examples of the snowball effect, which is possible as a result of unification. And if we look at the history of the Second International, it's perfectly clear that there was just such a snowball effect in relation to the Gotha fusion of the Eisenachers and Lasallians, which unified two small groups, both of which had paper membership, more or less around 10,000. But the result of the unification was to create a snowball effect, which grew very rapidly to 100,000 and then to mass scale election results. The same is true of the Austrian Socialist Party. The same is true of the unification process of the Italian Socialist Party. The same is true of the unification process of the French Socialist Party. The same is true, in fact, of the unification process of the Russian Social Democratic and Labour Party, in spite of the fact that the unification in 1903 immediately issued in a split. Nonetheless, the fact that it was unified, but it was two big public factions, the majorityites and the minorityites, identifying with the RSDLP, it was still the case that the RSDLP could grow by a snowball effect once there was a temporary opening of political conditions in 1905. So, can we do this on our own, CPGB? No, we don't have the weight or the presence or the numbers to be able to kick something off on our own. Can we? Can it happen? There's no reason why it can't happen. Except that people cling to the method of diplomacy, and by clinging to the method of diplomacy and the method of the ban on factions slash ban on permanent factions and all the other things which go along with it, they preclude that. And in consequence, by clinging to these approaches, they make our movement safe for the capitalist class, because from the point of view of the capitalist class, it's fine to have labor movement controlled by a loyalist leadership. And it's fine if the left is diplomatic towards the loyalist leadership that controls the labor movement. And it's fine if the far left is diplomatic towards the official lefts who represent a quote opposition unquote to the official movement. It's fine if the only choices which are available are the bureaucratically controlled Labour Party or a wilderness of sects. And I have to say that I count the CPB just as much. In spite of, the CPB has a daily, which means that it's in a would be in a stronger position to launch a unification than anybody else, except for the fact that it only has a daily, but courtesy of playing nice with the trade union bureaucracy and playing nice with the Chinese Communist Party, so that an actual movement into something else would be problematic. Nonetheless, it's still within the same level of the rest of the bleeding groups. The possibility exists. It's worth pursuing. It's worth pursuing because the alternative is fucked. And that's where I'm going to finish.